This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pynchon. I'll be reading synopses of some of the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery on July 26, 2013. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are neurosurgical history and pituitary surgery. The History of External Ventricular Drainage, a historical vignette by Visish Srinivasan and colleagues. The history of external ventricular drainage is fascinating. Claude Nicolas Lecat, a French surgeon, performed the first deliberate external ventricular drainage on October 15, 1744. The history of external ventricular drainage is best appreciated in four eras of progress: development in the late 19th century, technological advancements and expansion of indications in the 20th century, and the modern era. Many early attempts at external ventricular drainage failed, including Lecat's. W. W. Keane published the first thorough report in 1890. By 1908, H. Tillman's standardized procedure was followed for nearly 80 years. Manometry was added in 1927, which greatly expanded the potential of external ventricular drainage. Simultaneously, others continued experimentation in the usage of various catheter materials. In 1960, Nils Lundberg published a thorough analysis of the use of intracranial pressure monitoring in patients with brain tumors. He sparked a wave of studies in attempting to expand the indications of intracranial pressure monitoring via external ventricular drainage. Within the next few decades, external ventricular drainage became commonplace for treating the sequelae of subarachnoid hemorrhage and traumatic brain injury. The history of external ventricular drainage is a fascinating one, involving many important neurosurgical figures, including Keane, Dandy, and Ingraham. It highlights the steady progression of technology in neurosurgery and the evolution of patient safety. Socioeconomic factors associated with pituitary apoplexy. A clinical article by Arman Jahungiri and co-authors. Pituitary apoplexy is associated with worse outcomes than are pituitary adenomas detected without acute clinical deterioration. The authors of this study investigated the hypothesis that socioeconomic factors that may limit access to healthcare could be more prevalent in patients with pituitary apoplexy than in those with pituitary adenomas not causing apoplexy. This could contribute to the development of apoplexy, as lack of access to care could prevent patients from being diagnosed with an adenoma prior to the onset of apoplexy. The authors retrospectively evaluated patients who underwent surgery for non-functioning pituitary adenoma causing visual symptoms between 2003 and 2012 at their center. They found that there were significantly more unmarried patients and emergency room presentations in the apoplexy group than in the no apoplexy group. Furthermore, they found that lack of health insurance and lack of primary care provider were highly significantly associated with apoplexy. A multivariate analysis, including marital status, emergency room presentation, income, health insurance status, and primary care provider status, revealed that lack of health insurance is associated with apoplexy. Apoplexy patients with limited access to care were more likely to retrospectively report adenoma-related symptoms that occurred at least several months before the onset of apoplexy than were apoplexy patients with sufficient access to care. According to the authors, their data suggest that patients without access to healthcare are more likely to present with pituitary apoplexy than those with adequate access, for whom adenomas may be diagnosed before apoplexy can develop. Temporal bone encephalocele and cerebrospinal fluid fistula repair, utilizing the middle cranial fossa or combined mastoid middle cranial fossa approach. A clinical article by Matthew Carlson and co-workers. Temporal bone encephaloceles and cerebrospinal fluid fistulae represent abnormal communications between the meninges or subarachnoid space with the underlying pneumatized cranial base. Middle and posterior fossa bone plate erosion may result from trauma, prior surgery, long-standing infection, or destructive processes such as cholesteatoma or tumor. Recently, there has been a substantial increase in the number of reported spontaneous cases where no discernible cause can be identified. Within their report, the authors review 89 consecutive temporal bone encephalocele and cerebrospinal fluid fistula repairs that were performed over the last decade using a middle fossa craniotomy or combined mastoid middle cranial fossa approach. Among all patients, the mean BMI was 35 kilograms per meter squared, and 46% exhibited empty cella syndrome. Patients with spontaneous lesions were statistically significantly older, were more commonly female, and had a greater BMI compared to those with non-spontaneous pathology. 7 cases recurred. 2 of the patients with recurrence developed meningitis. The use of titanium mesh was statistically associated with the development of recurrent cerebrospinal fluid leak, postoperative wound infection, and meningitis. Also notable, 6 of the 7 cases with recurrence had evidence of intracranial hypertension. When the 11 cases that involved using artificial mesh were excluded, 96% of patients reconstructed with an autologous multilayer repair were without recurrence at the last follow-up. Surgical nuances and technical pitfalls are highlighted in the report. Thank you for listening to the Journal of Neurosurgery. The Journal of Neurosurgery mobile app is now available. You can find it in iTunes and the Google Play Store. Just search for JNSPG to download the app for your mobile device today. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter and now also on Facebook.